just make one mention also in these presentations, the fingerprints of divinity. We call it fingerprints of divinity because in a certain sense, these are interesting pieces of information that God, so to speak, left these fingerprints in this universe, in his book, in information that we can actually check out and somehow do forensic research and find those fingerprints. We have taken a small smattering of these different fingerprints. And Rana Rabbi Rieti is going to be moving on towards like the last segment of these presentations, and we leave it to him.
Okay. Thank you, Ryan. It's good. The next few minutes, we're going to cover part three of Fingerprints of Divinity.
Maybe just give everybody a minute if they want to grab a tea or just something.
You want to do that? You decide. Yeah. You decide. We're supposed to finish by 11:15.
We can go till 11:30.
We're looking for fingerprints that identify who is behind events. And we're going to look at one specific aspect which has many clues which are not obviously related. We're going to ask the question, when we put the clues together, what picture emerges? The very first prophecy given to the Jewish people was in Genesis chapter 15 to Abraham. There were two promises made to Abraham. You can look it up yourselves. One promise is that your seed will be an eternal nation. And the second promise is that you will inherit the land forever. Those are the two promises. Now, we've always had an arch enemy. Who's been that arch enemy? If we were to identify one specific nation that has always been our arch enemy, who has that been? Amalek. Amalek has been the enemy that's always looked to wipe out the Jewish people. When we ask ourselves who is or was Amalek, Amalek was a great-grandson of Esav. Who was Esav? Esau. Esau was the twin brother of Jacob. Jacob and Esau were in their mother's womb. Chapter 25 is the description there. And when they were born, she herself, in the pregnancy pains, said, "This can't be a normal pregnancy." And she was told there are two nations fighting against each other. One is looking for supremacy over the other. And in chapter 27, two chapters later, the story of the birthright, as in chapter 25, sorry, the birthright is sold from Esau, Esav, the firstborn, and he sells it to his brother Jacob. In chapter 27, Jacob then takes the blessing before Esav gets the blessing from Isaac, their father. And from that moment onwards, Esau promises and swears that he will be the one that destroys Jacob, his brother. The mother, Rivka, is worried, so she says, "You know, Jacob, you better run away. Go to your uncle's home and live there until your twin brother's rage has calmed down." And he goes for 22 years. And he returns in chapter 33 of Genesis. And what does Esau do? He comes with 400 soldiers to destroy Jacob and his family. At this point, how many members are there in Jacob's family? 12 sons. This is the first time that Jacob, as a nucleus of a nation, the 12 tribes, is about to enter the promised land. He was living outside in Paddan Aram and now returning to Eretz Canaan, the land of Canaan, in chapter 33. This is the first time that there's a possibility of the original two promises made to Abraham. You'll be an eternal nation and you will inherit the land forever. Here's the first time that Jacob arrives as a nucleus of a nation, 12 tribes in place, and is about to enter the promised land. Who comes to stop him? His brother Esau. His brother Esav. Question. Sitting in this room, nearly 4,000 years after these events are described, can we see a pattern that emerges that clearly identifies that each time the Jewish people, as a people, started to come back to our promised land, Who would stand up on the map of history to stop us, if not Esau and his descendants, Amalek? Let's look and see if there really is such a pattern, or are we just speculating? Amalek, sorry?
Amalek.
I'll explain like this. Esau, Esav, in chapter 36 of Genesis, there's given a listing of his generations, the descendants of Esau. Esav had a wife, Ada, who gave birth to Eliphaz. Eliphaz gave birth to Amalek. Amalek then became the name of the nation that was born after Amalek. And we are told, and this is written in the Talmud and in the Zohar, halachahi. The word halacha means law. It's usually translated as law. In other words, this is a description of the reality. And what is that? Halachahi. Esav soine et Yaakov. Esau, hates Jacob. That's a given reality. The question is, can we identify who this Esav is? In chapter 36, it tells us, Eileh told of Esav, who Edom. These are the generations of Esav. He is Edom. Edom is the name of the nation. Amalek, Edom. Edom is the name given to Esav because he was, Edom comes from the word blood, red. Edom is the color red because he was, his skin was colored red, his hair was colored red. So the first attempt, if you like, to stop Jacob entering the land with his people was in chapter 33. When was the next time? In chapter 50, when Jacob was buried, where? In Maras Machpelah, in Hebron. He was taken from Egypt, where he'd already gone down to Egypt. Remember the story? His 12 sons went down to Egypt, 10 sons looking for Joseph. Eventually they ended up becoming a slave nation there. And when Jacob died, right at the end of Genesis, chapter 50, he was taken by his sons to Maras Machpelah, the cave of Machpelah in Hebron, in Israel, the land of Canaan. And who should come there to stop the burial of his twin brother, Esau? This is actually mentioned in Yalkut Shimoni. That's part of the oral transmission in chapter 49 in the section of Genesis. But when was the third time, the third encounter between Jacob and Esau, their descendants? When was the third time? Think about it for a moment. The next time the Jewish people, as a nation, went to the land of Israel was when? After they left Egypt. After 40 years, after they came out of Egypt, who was the first nation that trekked from Mount Seir, 300 miles away, and made their mission to destroy the Jewish people as they come out of Egypt? Amalek. In chapter 17 of Exodus, Amalek, the descendants of Esau, come out. Amalek attempted to stop our entry into the promised land. Exodus 17, verses 8 to 17. Vayavoy Amalek v'yilachem im Yisrael b'Rephidim. And Amalek came and battled against Israel in Rephidim. Continues the verses, I'm going to read it in English. And Hashem spoke to Moses, write this in a book as a remembrance and transmit it through your Joshua. The actual wording is in the ears of Joshua. That I will blot out the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. And Moses built an altar and named it, Hashem is my miracle. And he, Moses, said, the God lifts his hand and swears by his throne. God is swearing to wage war against Amalek from generation to generation. And we actually have a statement here, I'm not going to read it all, in Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 to 18, which gives us a command to remember what Amalek did to the Jewish people when we came out of Egypt. Remember that they attacked us from behind. They are our arch enemy. When was the next time that Amalek appears on the scene? Well, the question we just have to ask is, if he's out to stop the double prophecy, the double promise made to Abraham, all the way back in chapter 15 of Genesis, if he's there to stop the Jewish people being an eternal nation, what human effort would need to be employed to stop a new nation being eternal? But how much of the nation would you have to kill? Every single one. Because if there would be one woman left of the Jewish nation could continue. We've had our more than fair share of persecutions, butchery, murders, forced baptism, gassing, hanging, burning. That's anti-Semitism. But how many times have people stood on the map of history and said, we're going to annihilate every single one of you? Happened twice. Happened twice. Besides Esau, when he came with his 400 men, that's really the first instance, there are two other times. When was the second time in history, after the Jewish people were exiled in the first destruction, after they were exiled from land, when was the next time that they were on their way back, and who tried to stop them? The story of Purim. What happened in the story of Purim? Jeremiah had prophesied that the Jews will return to the land after the destruction. Remember, Jeremiah lived prior to the destruction of the first temple. And he was the one that went around for decades warning the Jews that unless they corrected their ways, God was going to destroy the temple and they would go into exile. And he prophesied that the exile will last for 70 years and then they will return to the land. And what happened? The story of Purim opens with a description of a 186-day royal feast celebrating what? The expiry date of the prophecy of Jeremiah. According to the calculation of King Ahasuerus, the emperor, the king of 127 provinces, the empire of Persia, the purpose of that celebration, that party, which is the beginning, the opening of the book of Megillah, the Megillas Esther, the scroll of Esther, the purpose of that party was a celebration. That now that, according to his calculation, the 70 years was over. There's no fear of the Jewish God allowing the Jews to return to the land. Their speculation was that we have been abandoned by a God forever, at last. Now it's safe to celebrate. And he brought out the clothing and kalim, the utensils that had been pillaged from the destruction of the temple 70 years prior. And who arrives on the scene? Chapter 3, verse 13. Amalek's great-great-great-great-grandson, Haman. Haman, the prime minister to King Ahasuerus. What did he arrange? He arranged for the destruction of every single Jew. Why? Because the Jewish people were preparing for the end of the 70 years to go back to Israel. And courtiers were sent with letters to all the provinces of the king declaring the destruction of all the Jews from young to old. Lahashmid laharoik et kol ha-Yehudim. To annihilate and kill every one of the Jews. Minar v'atzakin. From the youngest till the eldest. Tav. And the babes, the nashim and women, b'yom echad, on one day. The 13th day of the 12th month of Adar. And included in the decree was the looting of all Jewish property. It sounds like a final solution, and that was the attempt. It didn't succeed. We know the rest of the story. But the question now is, here we have three attempts. Number one, Asaph comes with his 400 men. Asaph comes with 400 men. Then Amalek comes in chapter 17 in Exodus to stop the Jewish people entering the promised land. And then Amalek comes in the form of Haman, who was the great-grandson of King Agag, who was the king of Amalek, and he attempts to stop the entire Jewish people by destroying every single one of them. This way, the double prophecy cannot be fulfilled. We know the rest of the story of the Megillah, that God saved us. But it doesn't stop there. When was the next time, after the destruction of the second temple, that Jews began to come back to the promised land and form a new nation of Jews on the original land? The end of the 1800s, the end of the 1800s, the late 19th century. And what was that about? There were many different groups. Zionism was the beginning. There were also religious groups from Russia. There were splinter groups. There was no real political agreement or discussion, communication between them, that they were starting to trickle into the land of Israel and start communities, homes. And this is right at the end of the 1800s. And not only that, in the political scene with the Balfour Declaration, the White Paper, and even the League of Nations starts to sanction the idea of a homeland for the Jews. Herzl even negotiated, he agreed himself to take Uganda instead of the Holy Land. But others said, you know, there's only one Holy Land. But the nations of the world were beginning to consider this. And we asked the question, did anyone stand up on the map of history and say, no, we have to get rid of every single Jew? And according to our understanding, the pattern is, because if all the Jews come back to Israel, it will be the ultimate fulfillment of the original two-part prophecy, and thereby bring upon the Messianic era. And Hitler stands up on the map of history with the final solution. Destroy every single one of them. But how do we know that he really is Amalek? Let me share with you the following. 1700 years ago, the Talmud was written. And in Tractate Megillah, that is the tractate of the Talmud, which talks about the story of Purim, has the following statement on page 7. Such page 6b, I believe. The Amar Rabbi Yitzhak, says Rabbi Yitzhak, my dichtiv, what's the meaning of the following verse? When Jacob prayed to God, these are the words he said, Al titen Hashem me'avyei rasha, please God, don't give the desires of the wicked, don't fulfill the desires of the wicked, zemamoy al tafek yoroi musela, and don't remove the bit from his mouth. Ask the Talmud, what's the meaning of this? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Amar Yaakov, said Jacob, Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, before God, Ribbono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Al Titen LeEsav, don't give to Esav, HaRasha, the wicked one, Ta'avat Libo, the desire of his heart. Zemamo Al Tafek, don't take the bit, when a horse has a bit in the mouth that controls, that allows the reins to be controlled by the rider. Don't remove the bit from the mouth of this person. Zu Garamamia, this is Germania, Shel Edom, of Edom. Shilmale hen yotzin, because if they would be allowed to go out without this bit in their mouth, machrivim kol ha'olam kola, they would destroy the entire world. Now, 1700 years ago, was there a state, a country, a province called Germania?
Gomer.
Gomer. Oh, interesting. Very interesting. But was there a place called Germania? How old is the name of Germany?
I don't know. I saw the movie Gladiator last summer, and they were talking about Germania.
Okay, we're going to research this. Okay, let's look at this. When did Germany get its name, Germania? Any idea? Let me share with you the following. Sorry? Let me show you. This is the name in the Talmud, Germania. Says Rashi, our most classical commentary, Germania, the name of a monarchy from the kingdom of Edom. Edom is Esav. We described it in chapter 36 in Genesis. That Elo told of Esav, who Edom? Rabbi Yaakov Emden, 1695 to 1776, he says, Germania, it is likely that this refers to Germania, our Ashkenaz. Now why does he say likely? Because did Germany exist as a country in 1695 to 1776? No! In fact, what was Germany? Prussia! But more than that, continues the Talmud, V'amar v'chama bar chanina, Tlata mea katire tana'ika b'garmamia shel Edom. There are 300 crowned princes in Germania of Edom. 300 crown princes? What are you talking about? Sorry? Germani, the Vilna of Gaon, says, this is a man from the children of Gomer, the same spelling there, as brought in the Gemara Yoma. Gomer, this is Germania. The proper reading is Germania. This is the Vilna Gaon on the Mishnah in Negayim, chapter 2, Halacha number 1, Mishnah number 1. Let me explain this. We're being told by the Talmud that there is a place called Germania. That's the reading of the Vilna Gaon. And this place has 300 princedoms that, according to the Talmud, if they would have the desire of their heart, they would go out and destroy the entire world. 1700 years ago, there was no place called Germany or Germania. And what's this about 300 princedoms? You mentioned Prussia. Because there's different manuscript readings of Germania and Germania. He said the correct reading is Germania. Is the number 300 an exaggeration or a historical fact? Were there really 300 princedoms? W. L. Shearer, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, page 121. By the end of the Middle Ages, which had seen Britain and France emerge as unified nations, Germany remained a crazy patchwork of some 300 individual states. Columbia Viking Desk Encyclopedia, Columbia University Press, page 814. The Peace of Westphalia dissolved the empire in all but its name. Some 300 obtained virtual sovereignty in reference to Prussia. Hebrew Encyclopedia under the heading Germany. To the political disintegration of Germany, there were far-fetching financial results. 300 princedoms and free cities protected their financial independence zealously and levied the economy heavily with high taxes. Germany was almost totally excluded from the global economy and did not even take part in the colonial development of other great European nations in the 17th and 18th centuries. Encyclopedia Ha'ivrit Germania, under the name Germania, Index Germania, 432. What's being told to us is the following. Before Germany became known as Germany or Germania, it was Prussia, the Empire of Prussia, made up of 300 separate kingdoms. Question. What do the Germans call Germany? Deutschland. They don't call it Germany. What do the French call Germany?
Allemagne.
The British, Americans, English, we call Germany Germany. The Germans call it Deutschland. So where does the Talmud come up with this name Germania and connect it to Edom and say it's a nation that, given it the desires of its heart, will go out and destroy the whole world? Which one nation in the history of mankind made an attempt twice to just go out and basically take over the entire world? Germany. How far reaching was World War I, World War II? How much did they want of Europe, of the world? But it doesn't stop there. Did they know that their name was Germania? Yeah. Right. Right, I think you're correct. I think in the etymology of the word, Rome is the shoresh, is the literal root of that name. But we're showing something doesn't make sense. Where does the Talmud come off saying that Esav and Edom and this princedom of 300 states is known as a place called Germania that, given its desire, would destroy the entire world? Shael.
I have kind of a two-part question stated. I have a problem accepting that Esav came with 400 men to kill...
That's the description in chapter 33 of Genesis.
What he did was he asked how are you doing?
So if you read you have to read the verses carefully. Prior to the actual encounter where they end up kissing, there's hundreds and hundreds of gifts, one after in waves, that Jacob sent. Yeah.
The kind of gifts are really great. They come first 10, then 30,
right,
then like 200.
Right.
And like they're getting more and more impressed. And
right.
But Jacob, that's not a surprise. Jacob's a really clever guy.
Right.
But it's inconclusive whether he came to kill him or not. We know that he came with 400 soldiers, and we know that he didn't kill him.
Okay, good. So you know what? Let's put that aside as a possibility, all right? Because in order to substantiate that, we'd have to rely on the oral law, and we haven't substantiated the oral law at this point, which describes it as an initial attempt of war.
Okay.
But the Torah does describe it as 400 soldiers.
Yes.
Okay.
Can I do one more thing?
I'll tell you what, only because I'm really pressed for time, I have to take all the questions you want at the end, but I've got to finish this presentation in order to respect the next presentation also. How does this name fit into Germany, who themselves call their country Deutschland. Fortune magazine, December the 2nd, 1991. Sony, which laid down $60 million for a 7-acre parcel of wasteland near where the Berlin Wall used to stand, and not far from the site of Hitler's bunker, is unhappy with the city of Berlin's development plans for the area. They limit the height of the buildings to 115 feet, about 10 stories. The plans also impose a squat style that too closely resembles the Nazi architect Albert Speer's grand design for Hitler's dream city, Germania, which was to have been the capital of the new Europe, were Hitler to have won the war. Hitler himself is calling the dream city that would be the capital of the world, essentially, Germania. From Sony. So call it, check it out. Albert Speer had an architectural drawings for which were made up during the war in the assumption they were going to win the war. And the name already given by Hitler for the capital of Europe was Germania. Guardian of Jerusalem, Life of Joseph Chaim Sonnenfeld, page 200-203. When the German Kaiser Wilhelm visited Jerusalem in 1898, the entire city went out to greet him. Some out of curiosity, others in order to recite the blessing who has given of his glory to flesh and blood. An unusual blessing that you say when you see a king or a queen or a great sovereignty. Rabbi Sonnenfeld, however, did not go out. And he was one of the greatest leaders of Jerusalem at the time. His grandson, Rabbi Kupchitz, quoted his grandfather as explaining that he gave up the opportunity to recite the rare blessing because his teacher, Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskind, had said that he had heard in the name of the Vilna Gaon the German nation is from the seed of Amalek. They exhibit the classic symptoms of Amalek, externally polite and friendly, but harboring a deep and bitter hatred of the Jewish people. So here are the indications, you're putting them together. Where does the Talmud come off saying that there's going to be a nation that if God, says Jacob in his request, if you let them have their desire, they can destroy the entire world. Ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't stop there. Because this quote is taken from where? This quote is taken from Tractate in Megillah. Megillah is discussing what? The whole Purim story. Is there anywhere in the scroll that indicates to us that what we've just described is going to happen in history? I don't think there's anything in the storyline, but is it possible that some inconsistencies would open up some clues? Let's look at the following. Haman, we're told, was the great-grandson of Agag, the king of Amalek. Haman had how many sons? 10 sons. And at the end of the story, what happened to them? They were all hung. Hanged. Thank you. And the Jews struck... She's teaching me English. And the Jews struck at their enemies the stroke of the sword, slaughtering and annihilating. They treated the enemies as they pleased. In Shushan, the capital, the Jews slew and annihilated 500 men. And here you have the 10 names of the sons of Haman. The 10 sons of Haman, son of Hamdata, the Jews' enemy. But they did not lay their hands on the spoils. Here in the 10 names, there seems to be something strange in the way it's written. Can you notice? A little tuff over there. A little shin over there. And a little zayin over there and a slightly large vav. We're going to look at that in a minute because whenever there's an inconsistency in a Torah text, including the prophets or scripture, that begs the question, what's the inconsistency doing there if not to teach something that's not obvious from the reading of the text? Right after the 10 sons of Haman are hanged and killed, after they've been killed, what does Esther ask of Ahasuerus, the queen Esther of her husband? That same day, the number of those killed in Shushan the capital were reported to the king. The king said to Queen Esther, in Shushan the capital, the Jews have slain and annihilated 500 men, as well as the 10 sons of Haman, the dead. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? What is your request now? It shall be granted to you. What is your petition further? It shall be fulfilled. And what does Esther ask for? Esther replied, if it pleases the king, let tomorrow, lemachar, tomorrow, also be given to the Jews who are in Shushan to act as they did today, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. Why would you request to hang 10 dead people? Strange. And the decree was distributed in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. The 10 dead sons of Haman were hanged. Why would you hang 10 dead people? Usually you hang them to kill them. Let's ask ourselves the following. Sorry?
It's very similar to, roasting the sheep as they left Mitzrayim.
Yeah, we killed it first.
Yeah, but the sheep were an Egyptian god.
Yeah, when a person's executed, though, usually you don't go and do another type of execution after they're already killed. So the question is, why is she making a request to hang the sons who were already killed? Right? Now, we have a medrash. The medrash is part of the oral law. That's a presentation later on this morning, later on this early afternoon. The medrash tells us the following, that whenever you see in the scroll of Esther speaking to the king, Ahasuerus, those two words, king, Ahasuerus, it's referring specifically to her conversation with the human king, Ahasuerus. Whenever the book of Esther says she's speaking to the king, period, no name then attached, the medrash tells us it means she's talking to God, the King of Kings. Which kind of throws a different light on the text. Because then, essentially what her request is, she's saying, it's just to keep you awake. Esther replied, if it pleases the king, im al hamelech toiv, let tomorrow lamacha be given so that the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. Who's she talking to? She's talking to God. She's not talking to King Ahasuerus, just if it pleases the king. And where is this tomorrow? What's the purpose of hanging 10 people who are already dead? This is the question that's always been left open until one starts to look carefully at those strange sized letters. Because out of the entire 5 books of Moses, and scripture and prophets, how many times are the letters written in either half size or double size? Out of over 500,000 letters, 23 times they are written in half size. 3 of which are in this text. Taf, Shin, and Zion. And the question then becomes, what's this special correlation that these 3 small letters are juxtapositioned, and the big Vav, which is double the size of a regular handwritten Megillah, the scroll, what's it doing there? If we ask ourselves, what is the numerical value of Taf? What's the number? 400. What's the numerical value of Shin? 300. What's the numerical value of Zion? 7. You've got a total of 707. If that were to be a date, a time in history, it wouldn't be of any use to us because the year 707 doesn't indicate which millennium you're in. You don't know which thousandth year you're in. Yet we've got a very large Vav here. And we're told that the book of Esther was written with divine inspiration. In which case, the letters have significance, if that's really true. And if we put together Taf Shin Zion, 707, and we add the Vav, which is the letter 6, telling us it's in the 6th millennium, which would be 5,000, like the 20th century is 1900, then the 6 would indicate that we're in the year 5,707. What is significant about the year 5,707? 1946. Wow, you are good at math as well as English. Okay. Is there any significant event that we can think of, putting the clues together and ask ourselves, does this make sense? Putting the clues together, is there any significant event in the year 1946, which corresponds to 5,707, which in the context of Esther's plea to hang the dead sons of Haman, a descendant of Amalek, is there any event in the history in 1946 that somehow parallels this request? The execution of the verdict, the date 1946, corresponding to the 16th of October, happened to be the date of the execution of 10 criminals of the Nazis that were tried and found guilty for crimes against humanity at the Nuremberg trials. And what's significant about the Hebrew date on this calendar? The 21st of Tishrei. Which special day is the 21st of Tishrei? It corresponds to Hoshana Rabbah, Hoshana Rabbah is right at the end of Sukkot. Why is that interesting? Coincidence or design? Hoshana Rabbah, on the seventh day of Sukkot, we're quoting from the Zohar. That's the mystical work, Parashat Tzav, page 31b, written down in the 1300s. On the seventh day of Sukkot holiday, Hoshana Rabbah, the judgment of the nations of the world is finalized. Sentences are issued from the residence of the king. Judgments are aroused and executed on that day. And who were they? 10 sons of Amalek are being asked by Esther to be hung on this date. Here are the sentence. 12. Where are the 10? 2 committed suicide. Hermann Göring committed suicide 2 hours before the execution. There were 10 at the actual execution itself. 10 sons of Haman, of Amalek, are executed on the day of Hoshana Rabbah, corresponding to 1946, Tafshin Zion. But it doesn't stop there. Let me read to you the following. The Nuremberg Trials, International News Agency, the New York American Journal, 16th of October, 1946. Former Foreign Minister Joachim von Ribbentrop inherited Göring's number one spot of the convicts walking to the gallows, and the 10 sentenced Nazi leaders were hung one after the other in the empty, brightly lit gymnasium that stood in the courtyard of the Nuremberg Municipal Jail. All 10 Nazis tried to accept their death bravely. Most of them expressed anger. Some surrendered in an embarrassing manner, and others asked for forgiveness from God. Only Julius Streicher continued to rely on the Nazi ideology of hating Jews. His behavior was extremely bold, and whilst descending the steps to the gallows, kept screaming, "Heil Hitler!" Reaching the rope face to face, he stared once more at the officers of the Allied forces and at the 8 world reporters. They were all seated in one line at small tables along a wall directly in front of the gallows. The gallows. With the burning fire of hatred. What did Esther ask that they be hanged on? Al Ha'etz, on wood. The gallows. He stood in front of the gallows with burning fire of hatred glowing in his eyes. He stared at the witnesses and shouted, "Purimfest 1946! Julius Streicher, who himself was the editor-in-chief of the anti-Semitic newspaper under the Nazi regime, last words are, Purim Feast, 1946. 1946 is the same date that Esther asked God, King of the Universe, please hang the 10 sons of Amalek. You put all the pieces together, Tafshin Zion, of the millennium 4000, 1946, coincidence or part of a pattern throughout our history that whenever the Jewish people were starting to come back as a nation, as a people, to the promised land, fulfilling the original prophecy to Abraham, all the way back in Genesis chapter 15, Amalek stood on the map of the world and said, "Stop, don't enter." And God promised to wage war against Amalek in every generation and promised that we would win. Question. Did it come true? I'll end off on the following. You've seen in the 3-part series of the Fingerprints of Divinity, we've shared with you knowledge, information in the Torah, which no human being could have possibly put there, with the fish, with the animals and the signs that we saw from Rabbi Sushar this morning. We saw control over nature with the laws of Shemitah. I'm not sure if we managed to get to that. We've seen prophecies, totally irrational prophecies, which did not need to be made. You didn't have to put that there's not going to be another revelation. You didn't need to put that we're going to be dispersed after the second destruction and that we'll remain small in number. You don't need to make these prophecies, and then you don't have to put any risk of God's document on the line, unless there's no risk, unless prophecy is coming from a being that is in control of the entire universe. We've seen the prophecies yesterday of the destruction of the first and second temples. We've seen the archaeology, a parev, a completely impartial science, not being able to find anything that has contradicted a single event. On the contrary, smallest meticulous details described in the Torah, which didn't need to be there, have been verified as accurate according to the findings of archaeology. The question then begs, where is this all going? And we'll end off on the following story, which is usually given by Rabbi Ordman when he gives this presentation. Beautiful story of a gentleman who's convicted of murder and is in court. All the evidence is against him. Witnesses, supporting evidence. And the defense tries to give the best possible defense, but the evidence against him is overwhelming. And after the prosecuting attorney has had his go, the jury is asked to leave and come back with their verdict. But just before they leave, the defense lawyer says, "I have just one thing to say. This whole trial has been a sham, a bunch of lies. My client is innocent, and I can prove it to you, because in 60 seconds from now, from that door of the court will enter the person that is supposed to be the victim of my client. The person who's supposed to be murdered by my client will walk in that door. And you know the law, dear jury, that if there's any doubt in your minds as to the innocence of my client, you're not allowed to say he's guilty. But you're going to see." And they count the 60 seconds, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62. No one's walking in. And the defense lawyer says, "Members of the jury, you were looking at the door. Were you by any chance in doubt as to whether my client is guilty or not? You are obligated by law to claim him innocent. My case is rested." The jury goes out and comes back half an hour later. And the judge says, "Members of the jury, who represents you?" The one representing them stands up. "Have you come to your verdict?" "We have." "Is your verdict unanimous?" "It is." "Have you found the accused innocent or guilty?" "We found the accused guilty of murder." "Lies! You've broken the law!" Gets up the defense attorney. "You can't make such a claim! You yourself saw! You looked back! That means you were in doubt!" Stood up the representative of the jury. "It's true, we did look back. But you know something? We noticed something that you didn't notice. There was one person in this court who did not look back. Your client." When a person is absolutely certain of the truth, they don't look back. When the evidence is overwhelming and one knows what the truth is, one does not need to look back. We Jews have supporting evidence in our history, in archaeology, in our text, in our oral transmission, which we're going to look at, and we are left as the jury to make the final verdict. Is it true? The choice is ours. Thank you for your time.
That Noah had three sons, right?
Right. Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Right.
Okay. And then Shem became the Semites.
Right.
Ham went down into
Africa.
And Japheth went into Europe.
Right.
My understanding was that Germans are from Japheth.
Self-empowerment.
How then can they be Semites? Because Esau was Semite.
Right.
Can you explain that? I mean, I don't understand how you can say that they're
Japheth's the Greeks. Japheth's the Greeks, not the Romans.
Okay, Japheth
is Yavan. Japheth is Yavan, is the Romans. Edom, 36 verse 4, says that Elah told us Esav, who Edom, right? And it's only 12 verses there. You can look it up in chapter 36. Gives the exact lineage from Esav to Amalek.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
Amalek, the nation of Amalek is described many times in the book of Samuel, when we were supposed to annihilate the entire nation of Amalek and we didn't succeed. The king was the only sole member left.
Right.
He was given, for that one night, his wife. while he was in dungeon before he was executed the next morning by King Saul.
Right.
And that night she conceived and gave birth to Agag. Agag became the great-grandfather of Haman. Haman was a continuation of Amalek.
Okay.
Right. So
but
then the question...
Still, you're still talking about Persians. You're still talking about, like, Semites, right?
So what's the question?
The question is, if Europeans are... So are Germans Semites? You see where my question is?
You're using Semites in the connotation of Semites.
Shem, right.
Esav is the son of Isaac.
Right.
Isaac sonned Esav. Abraham sonned Yishmael.
Right.
What's the problem that they became our archenemy?
No. My question has to do with your claim that the Germans are descendants of
Amalek. And Amalek is descendant of Esav, and therefore they're Semites. Shem. If you want to go back all the way, you're absolutely right.
So they are. So they're not descendants of Japheth.
No, Japheth is Greeks.
Oh, that went
right.
Okay.
Right. You're welcome.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
When you said about...